Thanks for that. Coming up here on Newsday, why terror attacks have become the so-called new normal in France and other Western countries. We're also going to hear a disturbing testimony of abuse said to be suffered by gay men in Chechnya. Shaima Khalil is back in the United States.
That's right, Julian, our last leg on this amazing and eye-opening road trip in the United States. We're in the city of Boise, a blue island in the very red state of Idaho. We're in the northwest of the U.S. for this last leg, and I've been speaking to loggers, farmers, students, musicians, and refugees about what they make of President Trump's 100 days in office.
First, let's go to Paris.
Mesdames et messieurs, you have to stay back, please. The area is dangerous because of shotgun. Please stay back. Mesdames et messieurs, vous reculez, s'il vous plaît.
Well, that was a scene late on Thursday following a suspected terror attack right in the heart of the French capital. There will be an emergency meeting this morning of a security, defense and intelligence officials to discuss this latest incident, a shooting on the Champs-Élysées, an iconic avenue and tourist attraction, part of which have now become a crime scene. One policeman was killed, two seriously wounded when a man armed with an assault rifle opened fire on a police van. These eyewitnesses described what happened.
I was walking on the pavement. There was a bus full of police. The man parked just in front of the bus, and then he got out a Kalashnikov, and then he shot six times. I thought it was fireworks. Then he went and hid behind a lorry.
We were moving towards a car, and then I heard two or three shots, but I didn't realize they were shots to start with. And well, then there was just panic all around. Everyone started running down the Champs-Élysées just by instinct. I didn't stop to work out what was going on. I just ran too.
Olivier Guita is with the security and counter-terrorism company Global Strat. What did he make of latest developments from Paris?
There was really a major risk of a terror attack in the run-up to the French presidential election. The Minister of Interior of France had warned that the risk of a terror attack was at the maximum level. Both Islamic State and Al-Qaeda had called for their followers to strike France in the run-up to the election. And just 2 days ago, two major jihadists were arrested in Marseille. They were planning an attack in the next few days, also on a large-scale level.
What about the location? I mean, it couldn't be more French. It is a representation of France and Paris and the capital, the iconic Champs-Élysées.
That's exactly the modus operandi of Islamic State that specifically targets symbols, but also tourism areas. They want to cripple the different economies, as we've seen in other countries in the world.
Along with this claim of responsibility from so-called Islamic State, they've put forward a name, Abu Youssef the Belgian, and that once again throws a spotlight on a country, Belgium, from where there seem to have been an awful lot of terror suspects operating there.
The main point would be actually the fact that Islamic State claims responsibility within just 2 hours of the attack, which is very unusual for them, which makes me believe that this individual was part of the network rather than just being inspired or linked.
There are going to be all sorts of questions, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of finger-pointing with people, especially during an election campaign, saying the authorities aren't doing enough. But you do wonder to what extent you can actually prevent something like this happening.
You're totally correct. I was in France just yesterday. The presence of soldiers and police in the street is just mind-boggling. I mean, we're talking about 50,000 soldiers and police around France to secure different landmarks and also the polling booth for Sunday's election. And we're talking about 15,000 potential jihadists on the terror watch list just in France.
There's this terrible expression, which is terrorism is the new normal, but I guess that is the reality for a country like France today.
Yes, this is the new normal, and it has been the new normal since September of 2014, actually, when the spokesman of Islamic State called on its followers, you know, in the West to stay at home, not go to Syria or Iraq, and target the homeland. So that was the inflection point, if you will, of this new normal. We're talking about 7 foiled attacks in France since the beginning of the year in just 3 months. That's the new normal.
Olivier, thank you so much for your time. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure, Julien.
This is Newsday on the BBC World Service, live from London with Julian Keane, and from Idaho in the northwest with me, Shaima Khalil. Idaho, also known as the Gem State, a conservative state with a big rural community, the state voted overwhelmingly for President Donald Trump. And we're here because it's coming up to 100 days of the Donald Trump presidency, and Americans are taking stock of what President Trump was able to achieve in his first months in power. This is our last leg, and we've chosen the Northwest, very, very far from the capital, to get an idea about what people here think of the president's time in office. We're in downtown Boise, that's the capital, a really cool, buzzing area full of restaurants and shops, very different from its rural surroundings. And we're not very far from an area called Freak Alley, a really, really cool part of town that my guest can tell us more about. Frankie Barnhill, reporter for Boise State Public Radio. Thank you so much for joining us, Frankie.
Thank you for having me. I so appreciate it.
So tell us a little bit about Boise, because I know you kindly took me on a tour around the city.
Oh, yeah, we had so much fun on that tour,
didn't we?
We
selfied.
Yeah, we selfied lots.
I must say, before I forget, this is so much fun. So we were out and about looking at the graffiti, looking at the artwork, and I was saying, oh, my God, this is Instagram, this is Twitter heaven. And Frankie, they're saying, you know, for a non-millennial, you're really good with that stuff, Shaima.
You really are, though. You're so good at it.
for a non-millennial.
Yeah, but Freak Alley is a great example of kind of the youth culture and the arts that occur here in Boise and that have really kind of sprung up in the last 10 years or so. And that says a lot about this young culture. But there's also, you know, these dichotomies with communities outside of Boise that might be a little bit less, more traditional, a little less progressive, perhaps, and that really depend on, you know, natural resources very strongly.
And of course, one of those areas in the rural community is that in the forest, in the north of Idaho, because again, Idaho geographically is really interesting. In the north, you've got the forest, in the south, you've got the desert. Well, we drove a little bit to the north to speak about logging. Timber industry is a big employer in northern Idaho, and logging is a crucial part of that. I spent time at a logging yard and spoke to someone who calls himself the woods boss.
I'm Mark Mahon. I'm a third generation logger from Council, Idaho. I've lived here all of my 45 years. I'm the woods boss for Mahon Logging. When I graduated, you know, 25 years ago, you could pick your job wherever you wanted to go. Unfortunately now, our greatest export from Council are our young people. There's virtually no jobs available for young people.
Does that have to do with the decline of the industry, of the timber industry and the logging?
Yeah, we just do not have the accessibility to the forest that we used to. Adams County, where we're at, is two-thirds owned by the federal government. I look at it as this way. They own two-thirds of the land, so they are controlling two-thirds of the entrepreneurial opportunities for us.
For an independent business like yourself, you're saying that there is less chance for you to log because the federal government doesn't allow logging in the land that it owns.
No, the federal government allows the logging, but they are handcuffed through environmental laws, this process of red tape and planning.
But let me put that point of view to you, and I'm sure you've heard it before, but any environmentalist hearing you would say, well, wait a minute, what you're asking is for a chance to cut off more trees. And from an environmental point of view, you're destroying the wildlife, you're destroying the forests, and, you know, it's the federal government's job to protect the environment, to protect those forests.
But by leaving the forests for themselves, they're not protecting them. There are too many trees growing per acre. So by thinning out the total number of trees, we are being able to better allocate the nutrients and the moisture to the trees that we want, the healthiest, the proper species for that site.
Let me ask you about President Donald Trump, because obviously he came out with a lot of promises, bringing jobs back, but also, you know, his environmental policies that have become very controversial. How much of that do you follow, and what do you make of it?
We are a true supporter of Donald Trump and his desire to make operating and businesses easier and allowing us to be more successful. Following his election, we went out and immediately made two purchases to upgrade new equipment.
Really? Because yes. You felt that reassured that things are going to look up after his election?
Absolutely.
You know, one of the things that President Trump has always said is that the real America or the rest of America has been forgotten by Washington. And to be honest, standing here in Council, Idaho, Washington feels like a world away.
Well, I definitely feel there is a huge disconnect. It just seems contradictory that the decisions are being made in Washington, D.C. that are affecting policy out in the West, and they're stuck in office buildings.
You're saying that people who are making decisions about your business don't really understand your business.
That's what I'm saying. I would love to have the opportunity to have Donald Trump for a day and just show him that as the most powerful man in the West, he has control over these lands. And as a businessman, why are we going to spend millions and millions of dollars fighting fires when we can harvest it, put people to work, and make products?
Will you let him split a log?
He could do whatever he wants, just as long as he doesn't tweet about it.
Mark Mohan there, inviting the President of the United States to spend a day on his logging yard. The chances of that happening, I'm not sure. And the chances of him not tweeting about it, I'm really not sure. But you heard Mark there making points about the struggles, really, and the challenges of the timber industry and the logging part of it. Frankie Barnhill, reporter of for Boise State Public Radio, is still with us. And Frankie, you know, you heard what Mark was saying there about the challenges. I mean, and you know, is this an issue really for that part of Idaho?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think that you know, we heard throughout the election from people in rural Idaho who have felt like they've been left behind, especially those who, you know, do depend on natural resources, whether it's logging or they're, you know, using the land to graze for their cattle, etc. And there is that feeling, that really strong sentiment here, especially because in Idaho it is so rural outside of Boise that, you know, there's a strong streak of self-determination in this state and people, you know, who don't really want the government too involved in their lives, and they feel like government encroachment has gone too far, especially when it comes to environmental issues. And 60% of the state is owned by the federal government. The federal government, the Forest Service, and the Bureau of Land Management are the two agencies. And a lot of people have a lot of animosity toward
Absolutely.
Those groups.
Absolutely. And Mark was saying, yeah. You know, the people who are making decisions about our land are miles and miles away,
right.
Sitting in offices in Washington.
Exactly.
And
they've never
like
split
that.
A log in their life, in their view, you know? That's totally it. And that sentiment is strong.
It's interesting, though, because Mark made his feelings about Washington, D.C. and the Capitol very clear. Doesn't like it. He made his feelings about Donald Trump very clear. Likes him very much. I'm just wondering what other issues have come up. You know, I don't know how close people are watching politics here, the ins and outs of, you know, policy making of the Trump administration. I mean, you and I, we were in a town hall meeting where the Congressman Raul Labrador, he came to speak to the people face to face, and that got really animated.
Yeah, that was just yesterday, and that was the first time that any of Idaho's congressional delegates have actually spoken in public and have had a back and forth with the delegates. So it got a little heated, as we've seen at other town halls across the country. That definitely happened last night.
Everything came up.
And
healthcare
immigration
came up, yeah.
It was, yeah, exactly. It was healthcare. It was environmental regulations. It was abortion rights. All of the above. And people, I have noticed, you know, certainly in the same way that, you know, during Obama's presidency, the right came out, now the left is coming out, and really there were a lot of boos, there were cheers, it was loud and it was ruckus, and people are expressing their views on the left side of the spectrum in a way that I haven't seen in Idaho in the last few years.
From your reporting here in Idaho, you know, in Boise, but across Idaho, what are the main issues that people are coming out and talking about, the main concerns of those 100 days of the presidency of Mr. Trump?
Well, there actually is a large refugee population in Boise, and so that issue, that executive order, people had strong feelings one way or another about that executive order. That was one. You heard, when we heard from Mayor Dave Beter earlier, he mentioned the work from undocumented workers and how reliant the agricultural economy is on that work. And that's a strong, very, very big issue as well.
Frankie, thank you so much. Frankie Barnhill, reporter for Boise State Public Radio there. Frankie mentioned refugees. You'll hear from two refugees, one from Iraq and one from Syria, about what they make of President Trump's time in office.
And you think it's only boys? Shima enjoys a bit of logging machinery. I've retweeted one of her pictures.
Have you seen my tractor skills?
And as you say, you're looking very serious and concentrated, operating a log lifter or something.
Yeah, it's a log. I was trying not to break it because I think Mark was very generous. He's like, yeah, do you want to try? And he's like, yeah, careful, careful, careful. I was concentrating.
I think you did well. You look ideal for the job there. More to come from Shima a little later in the US. It's Newsday on the BBC World Service. Let's catch up with the sports headlines with Alistair Ross.
Yes, thank you. Marcus Rashford scored the winner in extra time as Manchester United beat Anderlecht to advance to the semi-finals of the Europa League. That 2-1 win included potentially serious knee injuries, though, to Marcus Rojo and Zlatan Ibrahimovic. Celta Vigo, Ajax and Lyon are the other sides who've won through. The biggest half-time post-season comeback in NBA history saw LeBron James' Cleveland Cavaliers overcome a 25-point deficit at the break to beat the Indiana Pacers. James also moved to third on the all-time postseason top scorers list. Feyisa Lelisa, the Ethiopian who made anti-government gestures on the podium at the Olympics in Rio, says he has no regrets and will make the symbol again if he's successful in the London Marathon this weekend. The government says he'd be welcomed back if he returned. The silver medalist fears he would be killed. And Tiger Woods has had more surgery, saying he needed pain relief. It's unlikely, therefore, he'll be back before the end of this PGA Tour season.
Thanks, Alistair. A reminder of our top headline this hour. France's President François Hollande says security forces are working with the utmost vigilance after a policeman was shot dead in central Paris just days before the first round of the French presidential election. Three candidates have cancelled Friday's campaign event. Let's talk business now. And joining us from Los Angeles, David Willis, and the world's financial leaders gathering in the United States. What are they going to be talking about?
They are indeed, Julian. That's right. Yes, we're talking about the spring meeting of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. It's taking place in Washington, D.C., on the home turf of an American president who, of course, has openly scorned the IMF's goal of an integrated global marketplace. Mr. Trump, of course, was elected on a pledge to tear up trade agreements that he said were taking jobs away from middle-class Americans and impose tough trade tariffs on China and Mexico. So far, though, he's pulled the U.S. out of the Pan-Pacific Partnership, a trade agreement championed by his predecessor Barack Obama, but taken a softer stance on other issues, scrapping plans, for example, to withdraw from the North American Free Trade Agreement, as he intimated perhaps he might, and rowing back on a promise to label China a currency manipulator. Well, since World War II, the IMF has helped America set the agenda for the world economy. How then will it deal with this new age of American protectionism, an administration whose leader rose to power by harnessing working class anger against the notion of free trade? We will find out in the next 3 days, but at a news conference at the start of the gathering, the IMF's managing director, Christine Lagarde, struck an emollient chord. She indicated that the organization was willing to work with the Trump administration.
Interesting, because to underline that desire for a freer and fairer trade, Mr. Trump's launched an investigation into cheap imports of steel from China and elsewhere.
He has indeed, Julian. Just as the IMF and World Bank meetings were getting underway a few streets away at the White House, President Trump was launching a federal investigation into steel imports from China and other countries. Elected, of course, on that promise to boost jobs in industrial states. He's looking to shield U.S. steel companies. There are, would you believe, nearly 100 steel plants across the country from the threat posed by cheap imports. Steel imports from China already account for more than a quarter of the U.S. market, and it's thought that the investigation launched today could lead to tariffs on steel imports, Julian.
Thanks, David. Now, it's believed that more than 60 gay men have fled the Russian Republic of Chechnya following what they describe as a campaign of persecution by the security forces. There are also allegations that up to 100 men have been detained, with some beaten, tortured, and 3 killed while in custody. The president of Chechnya, a conservative and mainly Muslim republic, has denounced the reports as distortion and slander. Well, our correspondent Sarah Rainsford met several men who recently fled Chechnya to a safe house. One of them described to her what he went through when he was detained. Now, he asked us to disguise his identity, so his words in Russian have been voiced by a BBC producer.
When they brought me in, I denied everything. They started to beat me, to use electric shock, to threaten me. They said they would find out everything anyway, so I should tell the truth. They have a special black box and they tie wires to your hands or ears and shock you. The pain is awful. You scream. It's terrible torture. Подключают ток, и когда током бьет человека... If beating you with their hands and feet is not enough, they use electric shock. It really hurt, but I didn't give in. Мне было очень больно, но от боли как бы я не сдался. Раньше это был как шантаж все время. They used to detain people before, all the time, to blackmail them. The level it's at now, it's extermination. На таком уровне это истребление, истребление геев. The extermination of gay men, so that there are none left in the republic. Chechens have no right to be gay. They have to be warriors, straight, sportsmen. Being gay is just not acceptable for them.
Это для них неприемлемо. Если они там кого-то убрали...
If they kill gay people, detain them, expel them from the republic, they can't get rid of gay men from Chechnya that way. There will be a new generation, new children. It's always existed and always will, like it or not.
Ну кто бы хотел стать геем? Я бы лично не хотел.
Who would want to be gay? I didn't. But as it happened, what can I do? I did everything not to be gay. I got married. I lived a normal life. But it doesn't work.
Это не проходит. Не получается это. Нет, я никогда не вернусь туда, потому что если даже не силовики.
I can't ever go back there. It's not just the security forces. My own relatives won't forgive me. It's a permanent stain. Our mentality means that even if the security services don't deal with me, my own relatives definitely will.
Родственники обязательно со мной расправятся.
The words there of someone who fled Chechnya, speaking to the BBC's Sarah Rainsford. Just looking at more on our top story, that's the terror attack in Paris. Just looking at some of the papers there in France, Le Parisien, its headline is Attack on the Champs-Élysées. It's got a picture of the famous Parisian avenue, cordoned off and empty apart from dozens of police cars. Le Figaro, its headline, Terrorism Strikes the Heart of Paris. In an article, it says, there have never been so many threats hanging over a presidential election in France. With Newsday here on the BBC World Service.
This is the BBC World Service, where we find out just how good it is to talk.
Life stories.
There's only one thing in life that's certain: death. When was the last time you spoke about it?
I wish death weren't so darn scary.
But there's a movement hoping to change that. Death Cafe, a social franchise that has spread across the world, aiming to break down the fear of mortality, where people come together to eat cake, drink tea, and discuss death.
It started with my sister passing away. To this day, I still actually don't know what happened.
I'm Julian Keane. I'll be discovering how Death Cafe began, exploring the theory that we live better lives when we embrace our mortality.
We are going to die, doesn't matter what. So we start to live better.
Dying to Talk, Sunday at 13 GMT.
Hello, welcome to Newsday from the BBC with me, Julian Keane, in London, Shaima Khalil in the United States. We'll be going to France, reading from yet another terror attack, which came just days before the first round of the presidential election. Also, we'll hear from the former South African president, now thinking of turning his back on the governing ANC party, and the Donald Trump presidency, as seen by 2 refugees who've now found a safe haven in America. First, the latest world news.
BBC News with Fiona MacDonald. The French President François Hollande has promised security forces will maintain absolute vigilance after a policeman was shot dead in central Paris. Two others were wounded in the attack when a gunman opened fire on a police bus on one of the city's main streets, the Champs-Élysées. He kept firing as he tried to flee, but was shot dead by police. French media say the suspect was a 39-year-old French national. Police have searched the suspect's home in the eastern suburbs of Paris and are investigating whether the man had any accomplices. The shooting comes just days before the first round of the country's presidential election. Three leading candidates have cancelled campaign events in the wake of the attack. Riot police in the Venezuelan capital Caracas have fired tear gas and rubber bullets at thousands of opposition demonstrators taking part in a second day of protests against the government of President Nicolas Maduro. Masked activists hurled stones and petrol bombs at police. Japanese media say the Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has sent a spring festival gift to the controversial Yasukuni Shrine. Those honoured there include leaders convicted war crimes during the Second World War. Neighbouring countries consider the shrine a symbol of Japanese militarism. It's estimated that more than 60 gay men have fled the Russian Republic of Chechnya following what they call a campaign of persecution by the security forces. There's been international condemnation after a report that hundreds of homosexual men had been detained and three killed. New research suggests that consuming artificially sweetened drinks on a daily basis may increase the risk of strokes and dementia. The study found that people who consumed at least one diet drink a day were three times as likely to suffer a stroke or dementia as people who consumed less than one such drink a week. BBC News.
Thanks. Hello. Welcome to Newsday. We will be reflecting on the aftermath of that suspected terror attack in Paris. We're also in South Africa, where a former president has been casting a critical eye over the governing ANC party. And we're heading off to Idaho in the United States. Newsday's Shaima Khalil is there.
That's right, Julian. We're reflecting on the first 100 days of the Donald Trump presidency that are quickly approaching. And to call them eventful is an understatement. The executive orders, the tweets, the controversy, all of that, what do people make of it? We'll get the view from a state that voted big for the president. We're in Idaho, in the northwest of the United States.
We go first to France, where we had expected the news there to be dominated by the final TV appearance of the presidential contenders ahead of Sunday's election. Instead, all the headlines today about that attack in Paris claimed by Islamic State, in which left one policeman dead, two seriously injured. As for the gunman, he was shot dead by police. Late last night, the French president, François Hollande, gave this brief statement.
J'ai convoqué un conseil de défense demain matin à 8h.
I have convened a crisis meeting for 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. Our security forces, our police, our military police will remain on the highest state of alert, as has been the case for a few months. And we will remain very vigilant, especially in light of the upcoming election.
Well, while all that was happening, the 11 candidates vying for the presidency were making their final pitch to voters on TV. The attack prompted this reaction live during the programme from the centrist front-runner Emmanuel Macron.
Nous aspirons tous et toutes à devenir.
We all aspire to become president of the Republic, and the first duty of the president is to protect. Tonight, while we've been talking, we know that at least one police officer has been killed. This threat is incalculable, and it's going to be part of our daily lives for years to come.
Well, to find out more about the impact the attack had on those pre-election televised interviews, I spoke to Hélène Bekmezian, deputy editor-in-chief of the online edition of the French daily Le Monde.
It was very strange because we didn't know exactly what happened and we didn't know how many people were killed. We knew one policeman were killed, but then there was a rumor about a second one. So on the television, the journalist said things that were false. So the candidate were commenting something without knowing exactly what was happening.
Is this the kind of issue which would favour one candidate rather than another? I don't know if any one of them were taking perhaps a sort of stronger line regarding these sort of terror attacks.
Well, there's Marine Le Pen from the far-right party who always said, we don't do enough to protect the French people. So maybe it's in favor for her, this kind of event. And maybe for François Fillon also, from the right party. So yeah, maybe for these two candidates, this could be kind of a good thing.
And just looking ahead to the actual sort of when we get to election day, there might be a fear also with with fear on the streets of France and other cities, whether it could, you know, affect the turnout on election day.
It's really, really, really hard to say, because even without this shooting, without these attacks, we've never seen an election like this before. We have four candidates. We don't know which one are going to be on the second turn. And it's impossible to know what's going to happen on Sunday. Everything can happen.
Can I ask you about the actual television, let's call them interviews, because it wasn't really a debate. Did we learn anything that we didn't know before about any of the candidates?
No, not really, because now the campaign, it's the end of the campaign. So we know all of the 11 candidates. We know the big lines of their programs. There was nothing new tonight. Actually, we are all wondering what was really the object.
The point of it,
exactly.
Because French people have had enough. I mean, there's been, when you've got 11 candidates, I mean, it's just, even the last debate, it lasted 4 hours. And this one, they had, 15 minutes each. It's just an eternity.
Yes, it's an eternity. It's very long. Everybody is fed up with this campaign. Everybody wants to be on Sunday, wants to know who is going to run for the second term. So this debate, I don't know if there were many people on television. I don't think so, because people are really, they are fed up with everything. They have seen too much political show, too much people on TV, and now we want it to end.
That was Hélène Besmekian of the French daily Le Monde. A lot of the main candidates have been tweeting on this. Marine Le Pen says we have to do something about the ideology of terrorism, which has been growing in France for years. François Fillon says the fight against Islamic totalitarianism must be the priority of any new president. As for Emmanuel Macron, he said he wanted to show his solidarity with the representatives of the police. This is Newsday on the BBC. Time now to move from London to Idaho. And I'm not quite sure, Shaima, if it's Boise or Boise. I haven't worked it out yet.
Ah, interesting. So it's Boise in Boise. So people in Boise call Boise, Boise. The rest of the
You've already
country.
Lost me.
So it's Boise to the local people of Boise. Yeah. And to all of us outsiders, it's Boise. And that's when they know that you're from outside the city.
Okay.
All very right. Clever.
What I do know is it's noisy in Boise.
It's noisy in Boise, I tell you. It's so lively. We are in Bitter Creek, a lovely bar and restaurant here in downtown Boise. And you know what? If there is a place that encompasses the contrast of city life versus its rural surroundings, it's this place. This is a buzzing, bustling metropolis. So many people have actually moved here for the lifestyle. It's a nice combination of city life, of jobs, of student life, but also of outdoor activities. We're surrounded by beautiful mountains, and it's interesting because it reminded me of the Margalla Hills and my time in Pakistan. Nature is just all around us. It's forests in the north, desert in the south. Really, really interesting. But yeah, a lot of contrast. This is a city that is a blue spot in a sea of red, as I've been told. The state itself has voted very big for President Donald Trump. I'm here with Emily Larson. Emily is a student at Boise State University, and you're studying political science, aren't you, Emily?
Yes, that's correct.
Now, tell me how much politics, you study political science, you follow a lot of politics. How engaged are your friends into the political, controversy and turmoil and the ins and outs of the White House?
I think we've hit an all-time high for political activism in the modern age. My peers are very active on both sides. So I'm affiliated with College Republicans, and so we're very active on our campus and within our community, but you see a lot of the other side. almost more of the other side, especially living in Boise, considering, as you said, it's pretty much the blue dot in the red state.
You said Boise there, so we know you're from here. Of course, we're watching the first 100 days of the Trump presidency. It's fast approaching. We're looking at what, you know, politics, what works, what didn't work, lots and lots of controversy. And of course, President Donald Trump's executive order to ban people from six Muslim countries, that's been very controversial, and his policies towards refugees and immigrants. I spoke to two refugees, Marwan from Iraq and Asma from Syria, and I asked them what they make of the Trump presidency.
Home is when you find safety. When I was in Syria and I felt somehow I will be killed, or my kids, one of my kids will be killed, I didn't feel home at all. When I left and stayed in Egypt, and I was scared because single mom in Egypt is really challenging. I feel home here because it's only I am safe. Some challenging, for sure. There is, people hate Muslims. As I'm, you know, I am from Syria and I didn't change my culture. I integrate very well.
And you're wearing the hijab, the headscarf.
Yes,
it's a beautiful purple, by the way, you're wearing.
Thank you. But for me, I integrate in my way. I don't change the rules I grow up with.
You know, in the last 12 months or even more, with, you know, President Trump, back then presidential candidate Trump, his rhetoric, the way that he spoke about Muslims, the way that he spoke about the region, the Middle East especially, but also, you know, in progression when he came to power, his policies, the ban on people from certain Muslim countries, including Syria and Iraq. I mean, Iraq now is off the list. How does that sit with you? I mean, do you feel that it's become worse for you? Has it not made a difference? How do you view that, Marwan?
It didn't make a difference, really. I've been here 10 years, the three elections, and I kind of had an idea about election season. In election season, your goal is to get elected. It's a marketing campaign. President Trump get elected, nothing get changed, or not a new policy was implemented aside from the ban, which was expected and was practiced by the previous administrations, by the way. It's not the first time. Life is the same. Life is going on, business as usual.
And what about you, Asma?
Well, to be honest, I'm scared. I'm scared because I ran away from the violence. I ran away from discrimination. I hate discrimination. I love everybody. So when I see someone, no matter if he's the president or anyone, specifically about somebody like Syrian specifically or Egyptian specifically or whatever, I don't like it at all. I feel when I heard anything about Syrian being bombing here or bombing there, I really scared.
And Marwan, I guess you've been living through this for a decade, because you've lived through the war in Iraq and then you moved to the United States and been watching it for years. What's that been like for you?
Just frustration. And you know, things will get only worse. And I hope they just hold the Iraqi government accountable for a lot of actions. To be honest, if the Arab leaders would intervene early with the Syrian issues, it wouldn't reach to that limit.
President Trump was adamant about the number of refugees that he was going to accept in the United States. You know, if you have a message for him about that, you know, would you tell him anything?
My first perspective about United States is a really welcoming country. And I hope this perspective stay like that.
What do you say to people who, you know, might be listening to you and say, but the thing is, we're not against refugees per se, but there are certain security issues that we have to consider. And we can't just let everybody in, because that would mean that our country is not safe.
Before I come to United States, I had at least 10 interviews. They ask me a lot of questions. They run background check also for my kids, even they are kids. So it's not for us like, this is your visa, congratulations.
Come in.
Come in. You have to wait and you have to be patient.
Would you ever go back to Iraq?
I do love the United States. It's a really beautiful country. I've been around 24 states. I really love the people. I have a lot of friends. But I buried my heart in Iraq. You need to understand that. And Iraq, we have roots there. And our roots is back to 10,000 years. I wish I can, but again, not in this political climate.
Thank you both very much.
very heartfelt there comment from Marwan Sweden from Iraq, where he says, I left my heart, or I buried my heart in Iraq, his hometown. Asma Al-Bukay from Syria, they're saying that home is where you feel safe, and she feels safe right here in Boise, Idaho, where we're coming to you from. I'm still with Emily. Thank you so much for being with us, Emily. Emily Larson, Republican student. I'm also still with Frankie Barnhill, reporter for Boise State Public Radio. Emily, you heard Asma there saying, look, you know, this is my home now. You're Republican. You supported the president. Do you support his policy on immigration and border control?
I do. I think that the intentions are not to be discriminatory by any means. I think that
but many people see them as discriminatory.
I can understand that. And it's hard to be able to reiterate that the president is looking out for the national security of all Americans. And that's not an easy job to do. And that's going to hurt some people in the process. But what we're trying to do is get to a place in our country where our own citizens feel safe. And in implementing things like the travel ban, we're taking measures against preventing potential terrorist attacks.
That point being said, I totally understand where you're talking about security and safety of the borders, but doesn't that, the travel ban specifically, and actually the ban on Syrian refugees coming in, doesn't that go exactly against what America stands for, which is welcoming people to come in and start a life for themselves?
Well, in the travel ban, when you read the executive order, it talks about the reasons why we chose these countries, or why the president chose these countries. And all in common, it comes with there are major terrorist hubs that exist within all six of these countries, and then they have also been uncooperative with the United States in preventing or in counterterrorism actions. And so at some point, we have to put our foot down and say that we...
But when you hear someone like Asma saying that finally she feels safe after, you know, first of all, she went through a very, very thorough, a very thorough process to get here, but finally she feels safe. Can you imagine how many other people, millions and millions of Syrian refugees, that want that chance?
Absolutely. And the thing about this travel ban is that it's a temporary action, and it hasn't even been decided by the Supreme Court yet what ultimately is going to happen with it. But we need to consider the safety of Americans, and with this temporary action, perhaps we can figure out better measures in order to actually bring people into this country and make sure that Americans are safe at the same time.
Frankie.
Yeah, and Emily is expressing a view that's very strong in Idaho, but there are, you know, some people who would disagree, especially in Boise. Like I said, there's a big refugee community here, and people have come out in favor of them, protesting at the airport, welcoming them. But then, you know, there's other communities where people do have real concerns that they think are, you know, to them are very real, and they're worried about their communities and what might be changing. And so there is a real dichotomy, especially between, you know, the city of Boise and then kind of the more rural towns outside.
Really, really interesting views there. You heard from refugees, and you heard how people feel about refugees within the city of Boise, but also outside in rural areas. When we come back, you'll hear from a man who not only knew the president, but appeared on the reality program before he used to be president, and that's The Apprentice. That's coming up from us here in Boise, Idaho.
And that's on Newsday on the BBC. And time now to get all the latest sports news with Alistair Ross.
Yes, thank you. We start with Manchester United, who are through to the semi-finals of the Europa League, but not perhaps in the way manager Jose Mourinho would have wanted. It took a Marcus Rashford goal in extra time to seal the win over Anderlecht, and it came at the expense of knee injuries to Marcus Rojo and Zlatan Ibrahimovic that could end their seasons. Mourinho was full of praise for their opponents and the raucous fans they took to Old Trafford.
They were fantastic. They were behind their team for 2 hours. They pushed them when they were up. They pushed them when they were down. I think it's a beautiful way for Anderlecht to be out of the competition with honor, with fight until the end. And I wish them good for the Belgian league.
Lyon, Celta de Vigo and Ajax are the other teams that won through to the semi-final draw on Friday. The Champions League draw involving Real Madrid, Atletico Madrid, Monaco and Juventus takes place just beforehand. That's around 6 hours' time. Ethiopia's Olympic silver medalist Faiza Lalisa is preparing to repeat the anti-government gesture he made as he won his medal in Rio. He's lived in exile in the USA since last year's Olympics, saying he'd be killed if he ever returned. The Ethiopian government has vowed that he is welcome to return. The athlete, though, says he's prepared to make the gesture again in Sunday's London Marathon. The biggest postseason halftime comeback in NBA history has seen the Cleveland Cavaliers take a 3-0 lead in their conference playoff against the Indiana Pacers. The Cavs overhauled a 25-point deficit at the half to put them one game away from a spot in the conference semifinals. LeBron James also overtook Kobe Bryant on the list of all-time postseason scorers in that match. He's still around 100 points short of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and 300 short of Michael Jordan, the only players who have scored more.
Oh, I mean, you just look at the excitement of my teammates after we won the game. To win on the road in the postseason is already tough enough. And for us to win in the fashion we did tonight is even tougher. So, you know, I don't think as a group we don't take that for granted. And we showed that emotion, you know, after the clock went to zero.
And Tiger Woods has announced he has had more surgery on his back. The 14-time major winner says it was to help with ongoing back and neck pain, and he's confirmed that he still intends to return to playing on the professional tour.
Thanks, Alistair Ross there. Now, we've heard a lot on this programme about the growing pressure on the government of President Jacob Zuma in South Africa. We're going to hear more criticism now, this time from former President Kgalema Motlanthe, who was Mr. Zuma's immediate predecessor. He's told us his vote for the African National Congress cannot be taken as a given in the forthcoming election in 2019, and he predicts the party could lose its parliamentary majority. He's been talking to our correspondent Karen Allen and started with comments made by the new finance minister at a conference in Washington.
If a minister can say, well, you know, the rand can fall, we'll just pick it up, that shows really a cavalier attitude towards a very, very serious matter. It's populism of the worst kind, where it's, you know, people who want to just say the, you know, issue statements that may resonate with poor people who have no understanding of the bigger issue. So it's really disheartening.
What was the moment for you when you said enough is enough, I have to speak out?
Well, it goes back, you know, more than a year ago when the Constitutional Court, which is the apex court of the land, said the president had failed to protect and defend and uphold the Constitution, which is his obligation in terms of oath of office. I thought at that point the honorable thing for the president would have been to step aside.
Did you tell him that at the time?
Well, you know, I made my views very clear even at that time, because it doesn't make sense when, you know, even in parliament, ordinary members of parliament, honorable members of parliament, now say he's not an honorable person to head the state.
Is it going to cost them votes come 2019, do you think, if Mr. Zuma remains president until the end of this year?
Definitely. Definitely. I think, you know, it, as I said, it's a great cost to the ANC in terms of its prestige and standing in the eyes of ordinary South Africans.
Let me be more specific. If Mr. Zuma remains until the end of this year as the leader of a party and not a great deal changes, could we actually see the elections come 2019, see the ANC actually lose to the opposition, or at least lose key ground in urban areas?
I think we'll see the ANC lose its majority. It will definitely muster less than 50% plus one. And it's primarily because, you know, you're dealing here with incorrigibility. You see, if you were dealing with one indiscretion and having to manage that and recover from it, it would be manageable. Problem is that it doesn't stop. You know, every month you are confronted by a new problem. And the problems revolve around the same individual.
Former South African President Kgalema Motlanthe.
You're listening to Newsday on the BBC World Service, live from London with Julian Keane and with me, Shaima Khalil, in Boise, Idaho. I'll say Boise like how everybody says it here, like a local. We're in the northwest of the United States, very, very far from the capital, but where the eyes are on the capital, of course, on the first 100 days of the Donald Trump presidency. How did the new man in the White House fare? His policies, or his tweets, his executive orders, and of course, the controversy. This is a state that voted big for him. Many, many supporters. Not many here in Boise. This is a big blue, well, sorry, this is a small blue area in a big, big red state. And I'm here with a man that not only has voted for the president and knows the president, he's worked with him. Troy McClain, former contestant on The Apprentice, the business reality show that starred Donald Trump, the then only billionaire Donald Trump, entrepreneur and business consultant. Thank you so much for joining us, Troy.
Thank you very much for having me here. Excited to be.
Am I right in understanding that at one point in your life, you wrote a letter to President Trump? He wasn't president then. What did you say?
That is correct. Yeah, my life was 10 miles to the left and 10 miles to the right, and I spent most of my time mending fences or skinning my fists on some logs. My mom said I had to set a goal, and she bought me the book Donald Trump, Art of the Deal, and in 1989 she said, Troy, you got to put pen to paper and you got to set a goal. So read the book, wrote in my senior yearbook, quote, Donald Trump, I'm coming, mailed it to him. 16 years later, there I did, meet the man.
You went and you saw him.
I did. I not just went and saw him, I went and worked for him.
So what was it like?
For me, it was a fantastic, amazing journey to come from the background that we came from rural America, to not having what the proverbial social elites called the PhD, although I tell everybody, I got my PhD. It was poor, hungry, and driven, PhD.
Right.
And to be able to go to work for the then Mr. Trump as a business leader.
Billionaire, reality TV
yeah.
star.
Absolutely incredible. And my life was exposed to the world.
Now, tell me about working for the man. We talk a lot about his policies these days, but of course, he's a businessman through and through.
Yeah, he's definitely a businessman through and through. And, it's interesting for me to see the evolution of Mr. Trump to President Trump.
Right.
And a lot of people ask, is he the same guy that you knew, and or has he changed? I don't think the question is posed correctly. The question should be, were you exposed to that same type of information and those opinions? Well, no, I wasn't. He may have had those opinions from the very beginning, but because we were in a unit of time that only talked business and not politics, and we certainly didn't have Twitter back then.
So you didn't see his tweeting skills. On a more serious note, of course, there have been many controversies during those 100 days. Just before we go briefly, what do you make of the travel ban, what he says about refugees, what he says about migration, what he says about welfare and healthcare?
I'll tell you what I make of it at the top of the hour.
Cool. Give us an idea, though.
Yeah, here's what I make of it. I think that he is speaking the mind of the overall America.
Oh, the overall America. The mind of the overall America is what we've been hearing here in Idaho. We weren't just here in Boise. We traveled north of Idaho. We spoke to some loggers about how they feel about the president. Big, big supporters. They don't like Washington much, but they like the man in the White House in Washington a lot. We'll tell you more about that. We're live in Idaho in the northwest of the United States looking at the first 100 days of the Donald Trump presidency. More from us when we come back.